Aaron apologized as well, then said, "It's not you who angers me." "Oh, no. You're just a close target." "How flattering." Kestrel was caught by her father. He had proof that she was spying for Haran and exposed her to the Emperor. Rashar considered this, his expression guarded.
"A new memory?" "Yes."
"What else does she remember about the general?"
"I'm not sure."
"You should ask."
"No."
"This isn't prying, Aaron. This is gathering information potentially relevant to our current operation. I'm happy to talk with her if you won't."
"Leave her alone."
"You underestimate my charm. Granted, she once pulled that dagger on me, but we've put that behind us. She likes me. I'm very likable."
Aaron didn't want to tell him about her raw eyes, or the stripped, thin quality of her voice. The way she'd wept, the utter abandonment. Her face, so alone, no matter what he said to her.
"She's in no shape to talk to you," he said flatly. "She rode for 2 days and a night with no food or water except maybe what she gathered along the road, if she bothered to do that. She didn't even know for sure that she'd find us. She guessed where we'd go and pushed herself to catch up."
The prince lifted his brows.
"Impressive."
His tone made Aaron wary.
"What do you mean by that?" "She's got a knack for survival."
It struck Aaron that Rashar could have pressed Kestrel for information before, back in the city, and if he hadn't, it wasn't likely out of deference to her ill health and recovery, or because he'd assumed there was nothing to be gained from digging around in Kestrel's uncertain memory. It was because Rashar wouldn't have trusted what she had to say, then. If he trusted her word now, it was only because she'd been damaged by their enemy. Which made her, Aaron saw the idea take shape in Rashar's eyes, a motivated asset to their cause.
"I don't like what you're thinking," Aaron said. "She could be useful." "You will not use her." "The general's daughter? We'd be fools not to. You talk about her as if she's made of spun glass. Know what I see? Steel." "You won't make her part of this war. I'm taking her back to the city."
"No," Kestrel said from behind them. "You're not..." Aaron turned. The sight of her. It wasn't just that she looked lost in his too large shirt, or how her eyes were tired holes. It was the set of her jaw, the way she lifted her chin. He'd seen this before. All the ships that shattered against the rock of her determination. How she'd break herself, too, if she must, to get what she wanted.
"Lock this slave up."
Her words, uttered the day she'd fought a duel for his sake, still hurt. What had followed? The clench of helplessness. Being outnumbered by her father's private guard. The first blow. The way she hadn't looked back as she'd let the door shut behind her. Humiliation. A sort of appalled admiration. Indebtedness. Later, her, injured and limping across the villa's lawn. It had changed him. Exposed something running inside him like a vein of soft gold, a slow attraction, growing, despite himself, into care and more. That incident last autumn when she'd tricked him, had him locked in a cell while she rode to the duel, loomed in his mind as a little story that told the larger one of how she'd been broken and he'd been kept safe, and how his safety in her brokenness had broken him. Now she stared him down. His gaze traced the fall of a single, newly plaited braid over her shoulder, its color obscure in the twilight. He recalled the fold of the dead Valorian girl's body over his blade, his sister being dragged to the cloakroom.
"You can't stay," he told her.
"It's not your choice.
It's not safe."
"That doesn't matter."
"I won't allow it."
"You don't command this army."
Rashar smiled.
"No," said Aaron. "Don't."
"What do you propose, my lady?"
"My prince, I wish to enlist. I swear to serve and rout your enemy and wash my blade with his blood."
"How savagely Valorian of you. Is this the traditional military oath? I like it. I accept."
She nodded slightly and cast Aaron an unreadable look, tinged perhaps with something like regret. Though it was hard to know exactly what had affected her. Maybe it was his expression, or maybe a memory floating invisibly in the darkening summer air, seen only by her. she left them.
If you send her into battle, Arryn told Rashar, she'll fall in the first wave.
Why? Because she's half your size. I'll wager she's had more training than the average foot soldier. She has no talent for it and little experience.
She wants this, Arryn. I don't blame her for wanting it. And quite frankly, I think her help could be crucial.
Her advice. Let her advise, then. Enlist her, rank her, if you must, but keep her out of combat.
All right, Rashar said. For you.
Arryn turned to leave. His head was brimming, his heart sore. Rashar touched his shoulder, surprisingly gentle.
I know you want her to be safe forever, but it's just not that kind of world.
Arryn begged a pair of Harani officers to share a tent. He shouldered the spare one, loosely bundled. He found a woman about Kestrel's height and bartered a little boot knife for a set of decent clothes. He rummaged through supply wagons and stared dully at the extra suits of armor, all far too large, swords too heavy. He considered a gun among the many rows of them, hidden in a false bottom below bales of horse feed. Unsure, he left the guns where they lay. Finally, he snagged an eastern crossbow. Even if Rashar kept his word and tried to keep Kestrel from any real military action, there was always the possibility of a surprise attack. He brought everything to Kestrel. It was full night. Light from a nearby fire flickered in her face. He tried not to look at her. He crouched and began to set the tent's frame. He drove a stake into the earth. Drier now. There was a pause after he hammered the first stake in. He straightened. I thought... Kestrel's voice trailed into the dark. She didn't say what she thought. She touched his wrist, light as a moth. Arryn flinched. He didn't mean to. He wanted to undo it. Yet flitting through his mind was a nightmarish sequence of images. A masker moth, the signed treaty in Kestrel's wintry hand, the Valorian girl he had killed at sea, his mother's bloody black hair. Kestrel drew back. He seemed to feel her echo his hurt. I can do that. She took the stone from his hand. My father taught me how to pitch a tent. I remember.
What else do you remember? Arryn wanted to ask, and was repulsed by himself.
He knew how much what she did remember wounded her. He hadn't thought it'd be possible to hate the general more, yet there it was, a hot jet of hatred. He said,
I won't spare your father.
The shadows were too deep between them. He couldn't read her face. She said, I don't want you to. 21. They continued south. Arryn kept his distance from her. Once or twice she rode Javelin alongside his horse. It went badly. He didn't know how to fix himself. He couldn't accept this. The first time she drew her horse up to him, he burst out.
For God's sake, you don't even have armor.
I know you're worried, she said quietly.
Your father wanted you to enlist. You fought him. Your music... You loved it more. You told me once that you didn't want to go to war because you didn't want to kill.
This is important to me.
You wouldn't have done this before.
I know. I've changed. He heard the truth of this in a way he never had. She'd said this many times, even insisted on it. The woman he'd known was gone. He heard again his promise to her in his tent. He felt the absence of hers. Yet it was wrong to feel hurt in the face of her larger grief, and the wrongness of it made him feel small. He looked at the sun in her hair, the ease of her seat and the saddle. Beyond her, a file of cavalry, an eastern pennant snapping blue and green. Fear choked him. It was hard to hear what she said next. A promise to be careful, to take no risks. It was so impossible and absurd to make any promise like that in war that he couldn't even reply. Eventually, she fell silent. The next time, also on the road, he noticed her weaving Javelin through the ranks to approach him. He twitched his horse left and found a reason to be somewhere else. At night, he waited until she had pitched her tent. He made sure not to set his nearby. She continued to glow at the edge of his vision. When camp broke at dawn, he'd catch sight of her bright hair, Notice her talking effortlessly with the Harani, or trying to learn Dakran from the Easterners. He watched the soldiers' wariness dissolve. They began to smile at her arrival, to like her despite themselves and her appearance, the very image of a Valorian warrior girl. She kept close company with Roshar. Aaron saw from afar the way the prince teased her, heard her laugh. It squeezed a fist inside him. At dusk, the pair of them played cards. Roshar bled the air with a string of Eastern curses when he lost. On an evening when they were about 10 leagues from Aerolith, Aaron came to Roshar's tent, which was large enough to accommodate a small table, a set of canvas-backed chairs and a collapsible bed, woven in the style and colors of the nomadic plains people. The ticking had feathers, not straw, and the table offered roasted fowl, hulled red berries, and a bowl of Eastern rice, rendered a shocking orange by a spice Aaron had tasted before, and found tangy, sweet, and a little bitter. There was a gourd of wine and 2 pewter cups, 2 plates.
"And lo," Roshar said from where he lounged in his teak chair with its swoop of green cloth, "the reins opened and the stranger was a stranger no more."
Aaron looked at him.
"Poetry," Roshar explained, "though it doesn't scan so well in your tongue. You're expecting someone." "Maybe. You'll do for now. Sit with me. Kestrel." "Pardon me? Are you expecting Kestrel?"
The question came out flat. Roshar coughed.
"No," he drawled,
but Aaron didn't like the humor in his voice. He sat anyway and watched Roshar prepare a plate for him, which wasn't at all expected of an Eastern prince and his guest, but Roshar sometimes liked to play the prince and sometimes didn't.
"Kestrel has raised the issue of Valorian scouts. We can't expect to be wholly unnoticed tramping along the main southern road. There's been no attack."
Which was what Aaron thought would ensue if the Valorians became aware of their movements.
"She wagers that the general has noticed the concentration of our forces at Lerilin. Whether he knows of this contingent is unclear, but he might be refraining from attacking us because he doesn't want to position forces north of Aerolith when his supply lines run south of it. Or maybe he thinks we'll choose to defend the wrong estates and he can seize his prize unchallenged. Why confront us now and pay the price in blood if we'll waste our energies elsewhere while he takes what he wants? Of course Aerolith could be the wrong estate." "If Kestrel says that's the one, she's right." "I agree."
Roshar drank his wine. Aaron tried to eat.
"Have you ever bested her at cards? Borderlands? Anything?" "She murders me," Roshar complained. "You spend a good deal of time with her."
Roshar's cup paused in mid-air.
"Aaron."
Swift jealousy, a caged resentment.
"I'm not, shall we say, interested in Kestrel."
The prince's expression changed slightly, and in the pause that followed, a slow thought occurred to Aaron, one that offered an entirely new explanation for why Roshar's soldiers had done nothing when Aaron had pushed him into the shadowed trees.
"Women don't interest me that way," Roshar said.
It seemed to Aaron that he had understood this for a long time without actually realizing that he did. He caught Roshar's expression, which on another man Aaron might have called tentative, but on the prince looked closer to soft curiosity. His black eyes were quiet. Aaron felt things shift between them into more intricate patterns than before.
"I know,"
Aaron told him.
"Oh, do you?"
A wicked grin.
"Would you like to know for sure?"
Aaron flushed.
"Roshar."
He floundered for what to say. The prince laughed at him. He filled Aaron's cup.
"Drink fast, little Harani. As you astutely observed, I've someone else coming tonight, and while your company is almost always welcome, here's this company I will best enjoy alone."
Kestrel waited outside Aaron's tent. It was a muzzy sort of night, too warm for a fire. The camp was a dark terrain. He didn't see her clearly, just the shape of her.
"I brought you something."
She held out her hand and dropped a round object into his. He knew it instantly. He ran fingers over its firm, lightly pebbled surface.
"An orange."
"I found a tree not far from camp and took as many as I could carry. Most I gave away. This one,
I thought we could share. He jumped the orange from one hand to the other, marveling at it. She said, I didn't know whether you like them.
I do.
Did you tell this to me once? Did I forget?
I never told you. Actually,
he rolled it in the well of one palm.
I love them.
He could have sworn that she smiled in the dark. Then what are you waiting for? He dug his thumb in and peeled it open. Its perfume sprayed the air. He halved it and gave Kestrel her share. They sat on the grass outside his tent. They'd camped in a meadow not far from the road. He touched the grass sleek beneath his fingers. He ate. The fruit was vibrant on his tongue. It had been years.
Thank you.
He thought he saw her mouth curve, and he was washed by a breathless nervousness. He spat a seed into his palm and wondered what little kernel lay in the folds of this moment. Then he told himself to stop thinking. An orange, a rare enough pleasure. Just eat. After a moment, he asked,
How are you?
Better. Before, it was like I was trying to navigate a new country where there was no such thing as the ground. At least now I know where I stand. He heard the sound of her brushing her hands clean, and then the sound of things unsaid, of words weighed and found wanting, sorrow radiating from her, the low throb of it. Gently, he asked,
Are you truly better?
He heard her breath catch.
You don't have to be better.
The silence expanded. He said,
I wouldn't be.
Her voice was a mere thread. How would you be? He thought of the wrongness of loss, how as a child he'd step right into it and fall and then would blame himself not only for everything he hadn't done when the soldiers had invaded his home, but also for his fathomless grief. He should see the gaping holes in his life, avoid them. Step carefully, Aaron. Why can't you step carefully? Mother, father, sister. What could you say about someone who walked daily into his grief and lived at the bottom of its hole and didn't even want to come out? He remembered how he'd begun to hate himself, the sculpting of his anger. He thought about how certain words mean themselves and also their opposites, like cleave, come together, split apart. He thought about how sorrow limns the places where parts of you join, your past and present, loves and hates. It sets a chisel into the cracks and pries. He wanted to say this, yet worried. He feared saying the wrong thing. He feared that his anger for her father might twist what he wanted to say. And he wasn't sure, suddenly, if he should answer her question. If, by answering it, he might, without meaning to, push his own loss into the place of hers, or make hers look like his. He stared at the dark outline of her face. Her question overwhelmed him. Until it didn't. Until he seemed to be able to see in the dark. He knew how she must be tightening her jaw, how she was curling her nails into her palms. He knew her.
I think that you try hard to be strong. You don't have to be.
He would want me to be strong. This made Aaron too angry to trust himself to speak. She said, I've been trying to tell you something since I've come here. And he had avoided her, letting her know in more ways than one that she needed to leave. He felt ashamed. His hands were empty. The orange rinds had fallen to the dirt.
I'm sorry. I've been unbearable.
Just scared. And there weren't even spiders involved. This was like her, the way her voice became light when something was hard.
Please, he said, tell me.
I remembered more about my last day in the Imperial Palace than I said when I first joined your army. I thought that maybe it would hurt you if I said.
Tell me anyway.
You came to me in the palace music room.
Yes,
he remembered, his palm flat against the music room door, opening it, seeing her face go white. My father heard our conversation. He was listening in a secret room, one built for spying, hidden behind a screen in the shelves. Understanding gripped him. It all rushed sickeningly through his brain. The gesture of her slim hand lifted, trembling to ward him away as he stood on the threshold of the music room. He'd barreled ahead. She had told him to leave. He had come closer.
"I tried to warn you that he was there," Kestrel said. "Nothing worked."
She had reached for a pen and paper. A note, he realized now. She'd meant to write what she couldn't say out loud. He'd wrenched the pen from her hand and dashed it to the floor. This was how it must feel, he thought, to take a knife to the gut. Kestrel was talking rapidly now, voice unsteady.
"He hadn't come to spy on me, only to listen to me play. It was hard for us to talk with each other, easier to have an open secret between us. He would come and listen, and he could pretend that he wasn't really there. But I was happy to have him hear me. Then you opened the music room door. I felt... I remember how I felt. I didn't mean what I said. I was insulting. I'm sorry."
"Don't say that. Not to me. I failed you."
"I never trusted you enough to give you the chance to fail me, or not fail me. I am sorry. I was cruel, not only to protect you from my father. I wanted to protect myself, too. I couldn't bear for him to know. But what if I'd given up on all those secret ways to try to tell you he was hiding behind the screen? I could have just told you. I could have admitted to what I'd done and let him hear it. Yes, I agreed to marry the prince so that you could have your independence. Yes, I was Tenson's spy. Yes, I loved you."
There was a silence. Fireflies lit the distance.
"Why didn't I say that then? I wonder what would have happened if I had."
"And now," he wanted to ask, "do you love me now?"
He felt her uncertainty. He felt, as if it had already happened and he'd already asked, the damage of forcing the question. She spoke as if she'd heard it anyway.
"You are important to me," she said,
and touched his face. Important. The word swelled and deflated. More than he'd thought, less than he wanted. But this, her touching him, how his blood jumped. He stayed very still. No more mistakes. He couldn't afford any. He would do nothing. Something. No. She found the curves of his closed eyelids, the shape of his nose, the divot above his mouth, the rasp along his jaw where he hadn't shaved. His skin began to dream. Then his pulse, his flesh, right down to the bones. She shifted on the grass. Green and orange perfumed the air. It was on her skin. She tasted like it, too, when her mouth brushed his, and their noses bumped awkwardly, and he wished he could see her as she breathed the laugh, and his hands went into her hair despite himself, despite what he told her the night before he'd left his home, about what was enough and what wasn't. The tang of citrus on her tongue. He forgot himself. He moved her beneath him and felt their bodies mark the grass. A fluffy breeze stirred the heavy air floating over the arch of his back. She tugged up his shirt, and he went down onto his elbows. The hilt of her dagger dug into his belly. He stayed where he was, her palms warm water flowing over his skin. He didn't want to make a sound. Even his blood seemed loud as he kissed her. Then a campfire lit the near dark. Startled, he pulled away. He could see her face better now. Slow eyes, a blurry mouth, and a question stealing across her expression. He'd imagined this before, or something close to it.
"Close enough," he decided,
but then had the sudden worry that if before she had come to him in his suite, because she had wanted to remember, maybe this time, knowing what she knew now, he was just a way for her to forget. He pushed himself up. He heard a rustle as she sat up too, and wrapped her arms around her trousered knees. He kept his eyes off her. He straightened his shirt, but it felt odd, like it didn't fit him anymore. The sticky air cooled between them. He pushed damp hair off his brow. His limbs, so certain of themselves only moments ago, became an awkward jumble. Kestrel said,
"Will you tell me about the day we met?"
This was unexpected.
"It wasn't a nice day."
"I want to know everything from then until now."
"Still unsure," Aaron said.
"But you haven't before."
"I trust you. You won't lie to me."
So he began to tell her, with a hesitancy that eventually steadied as a nearby campfire died down and the night surrendered fully to its creatures, the singing insects, the almost soundless flap of bat wings, a breeze that flowed with a mellow scent of cooling earth. As he spoke, it seemed to him that this was really the only story he wanted to tell. He kept nothing from her. Somehow they ended up lying down again, side by side, the grass dense beneath them as they talked. The moon above was large, yet intimate. Questions and answers were lifted out into the dark. Sometimes Kestrel recalled a moment Arryn described, and then it felt to Arryn as if he'd looked into a mirror and saw her instead of his own reflection. They talked long and late. 22. As they neared the first village on the outskirts of Aerolith, Kestrel considered it. Why didn't she know what she felt for him? It shouldn't be hard to figure out. She knew enough, remembered enough of her past, to guess the strength of the emotions she had hidden. Yet the tether between her and the past felt like it could snap with a mere twist. One memory ruled her mind, how her father had pushed her away from him as her heels skidded the floor and she begged. Arryn's horse, galled by something unseen, tossed its head. He muttered at the creature, crooned practically. Even at its roughest, there was always a musical quality to his voice. Then glanced slantways through the sun at Kestrel. His brown hair fell over his scarred brow. They'd slept little the night before, but she didn't feel sleepy, not now, as he regarded her. A thought etched itself in unreadable patterns across his face. There was a delay, and she grew nervous. She wondered whether what changed his expression was regret, and if it was regret, what did he regret? What they hadn't done last night, or the secrets they had shared? Some of what he'd said still made her hesitate, like his role in the Eastern Fire that killed her friend, Ronan. Even if Arryn hadn't intended her friend's death, even if when he had learned of it, she had felt Arryn's regret, she knew that the regret was for her sake, not for Ronan. It was disorienting to be reminded of things she hadn't known she'd forgotten. To have a friend, a whole person, Ronan, rise up inside her, only to vanish. She remembered how she'd mourned him. She mourned him again. Kestrel held Arryn's gaze. She didn't break it as he held himself loose in his saddle. His body rocked slightly in rhythm with the stride of his horse. She wasn't sure she wanted him to speak now. His voice had the power to call whole memories into being. Even when he was silent, she was awake to the supple quality of his voice, grave, slow, graveled, graceful. Clear, sometimes so transparent with feeling that she wondered how he had ever deceived her in those first months in her household. With a voice like that, it shouldn't have been possible. He studied her. This, too, should be impossible, the way a kind of wonder tinged his expression. Surprised, a little amused. Arryn reached across the narrow space between them. With a dusty finger, he briefly touched her nose. "You freckle in the sun," he said, and smiled. She felt suddenly light and sheer, as if this moment were encased in golden glass. Maybe love was easy, she thought. Maybe her past wasn't as vital as her present, she thought. But then she heard her father say that she'd broken his heart. And she could no longer believe that either thought was true. Arryn was against riding through the village. Kestrel heard him argue with the prince. Scouts had run ahead and learned that the general's army had seized, uncontested, an estate just south of Aerolith. The Valorians would move north soon and fall on Aerolith's farmlands. They'd butcher the sheep, seize grain, add another link in the supply chain running from Ithria Island, fortify themselves for a farther push north toward the city.
"We need to position ourselves in the hills outside the estate," Arryn said. "Now."
"What?" Roshar said.
"Would you leave the village undefended?"
"Of course not. Garrison a contingent. You don't need to parade the whole army down its streets."
"The whole army?"
"Not so. You forget. 3/4 of our forces lie at Lirilin. We brave few are all that stand between these villages and bloody dominion." Roshar sounded merry.
This is not a play, Arryn said through his teeth.
Kestrel didn't understand Arryn's discomfort until the prince said,
Let them get a look at you.
Even then, Kestrel didn't fully understand until she saw it happen. Although the Harani and Easterners usually marched in discreet brigades, Rishar gave orders for them to mingle. On the road outside the village, he took a personal artistic interest in arranging the visual appearance of, as he put it,
friendship in the face of adversity,
a phrase that made Arryn cringe. Rishar bullied Arryn into the front of the ranks alongside him. The prince caught Kestrel's eyes. She saw the gleam of strategy in his and responded to it. She held Javelin slightly back. They entered the village, Rishar and Arryn riding abreast. Villagers lined the main road, packed thickly, small children lifted onto grown shoulders. When the villagers saw Arryn, their eyes widened with excitement. There was a murmur. People surged forward. They tried to touch him. Arryn's horse didn't like it, and it huffed and stamped. Arryn hissed fiercely at Rishar in the eastern tongue. It sounded like a curse.
If you're so worried they'll be trampled, Rishar drawled loudly in Harani. Get down off your horse and greet your people.
Arryn glanced over his shoulder at Kestrel, a wordless plea. Then he dismounted, and she lost sight of him in the sea of people. She drew Javelin up alongside Rishar. What are you doing?
Don't you think our boy deserves some love?
I think you're using him to make yourself and your people look good by association.
The prince smiled, spreading his hands helplessly. Kestrel dismounted and made her way through the villagers. She used her elbows. A few sharp words, too, which drew surprised looks that quickly hardened into shock. She saw them see her Valorian features. Suspicion and hatred unfolded on their faces. They hadn't noticed her when she'd ridden with the army. Their eyes had been on Arryn, but they noticed her now.
Please let me through, she said.
The press of bodies grew more solid. This wasn't the city where everyone knew about her. All the villagers knew was their own past engraved in her eyes, her hair, the shape of her face. Murder and oppression mixed right into the color of her skin.
You,
someone said, hard and flat. Wary, she backed away. People surrounded her. Someone from behind seized her hand. She yanked it free, pulse high and stuttering. She tried to turn, then heard,
Kestrel!
Arryn shouldered someone aside and reached for her hand again, gripping it firmly this time. She felt a rush of relief and foolishness for thinking to help Arryn and becoming the person who needed help. But the crowd's anger wasn't going away. If anything, it intensified.
What is she doing here?
Kestrel couldn't tell who'd said it.
She's my friend, Arryn answered. Give her room.
They did. It was strange to look at Arryn through her own eyes, and also through theirs, to see the real and imagined person, and to know that what they imagined him to be was true, even if it wasn't the whole truth. There was a solid command in his voice, his frame. There was the aura of Arryn's singularity, the way he seemed like no one else, like he was a little more than human. But there was also his anxiety, traveling through their interlaced fingers, and the hunted quality to his expression. His mouth wasn't right. She didn't think they saw that.
Stay with me, he murmured in her ear.
Yes. With her beside him, he walked among the villagers. They kept touching him. Each time she felt the slight tremor of his reaction, quickly stilled. He tried to be at ease, yet mostly failed. She wasn't sure if the villagers noticed. They smiled, asked questions, voices riding high. Arryn didn't let go of her hand. At least he didn't let go until a woman pressed her swaddled infant against his chest. Awkward, quick, Arryn brought both arms up to hold the baby against his leather armor. He stared at the mother, as if questioning her sanity.
Bless him, the woman said.
What?
Bless him, by your God!
Arryn looked down at the cradled boy who slept, eyelids delicate, his cheeks round with health. A tiny flower of a hand peeked out of the swaddling. It flexed and curled against the cloth. Hoarsely, Arryn said,
My God!
Please!
But you don't know. Who, I mean. My God!
It doesn't matter, If your god cares for my son the way he cares for you, that's all I want.
Arryn's eyes flew to Kestrel's. Is there any harm? Kestrel asked, but still he wouldn't do it. Sternly, the mother told him,
You'll offend your god if you don't share his blessing.
Arryn shifted the baby more securely against him. Fingers tentative, he touched the baby's brow. The child sighed. Arryn's face changed. He softened, grew luminous, the way certain early hours of certain days are pearled, quiet and rare. Kestrel seemed to feel with her own fingertips the baby's fresh skin beneath Arryn's touch. The baby opened his eyes. They were her Ronnie Gray. Arryn murmured words, too low for Kestrel to hear. Then he settled the baby into the waiting arms of the mother, who appeared satisfied. She made the Harani gesture of thanks, which Arryn returned. There was something about the way he did it that reminded Kestrel that the gesture could mean an apology as well. Arryn's hand found hers again. He felt slightly unfamiliar. Something had changed between them. She knew why it changed her to see Arryn hold this child. She understood the question that had opened inside her, but she was unprepared. She hadn't thought of this. Her heart raced with an emotion too complicated for either fear or happiness. She released Arryn's hand.
Ready to go back?
Her voice didn't match how she felt. It was cool, even careless. She realized that this particular voice was perhaps her most treasured armor. Arryn's expression closed.
Yes.
The crowd cleared a path for them. They returned to their horses and mounted.
See, Rashar said. Wasn't that fun?
Arryn looked ready to shove the prince off his horse. The army moved from the road into a meadow that swelled into hills. It was near misery for the horses that dragged the light cannon and supply wagons, but Rashar wanted the high ground. Kestrel wanted the cover of the forest edging the higher hills, as well as the proximity to Aerolith's manor with its fortified walls, visible but a day's ride away. Arryn didn't say what he wanted. He said little of anything. A stream swiveled down through the meadow, a clear rill bordered by tufted grass. The air pulsed with the sound of cicadas. Rashar called a halt. Kestrel let Javelin drink and dropped to her knees beside him, cupping water to her mouth down her sweaty neck. Delicious, chill.
The water,
she said to no one in particular. Her father would want this estate for its abundant fresh water, even more than for the stores behind the manor walls, or for the sheep ranging the hilltops. This much water this far south was a prize. Arryn's horse nosed past her to reach the stream. She looked up, expecting to see its rider, but Arryn wasn't there. She found him sitting far off on a knoll overlooking the slopes that curved and gentled down. The village sat in the distance like a gray pebble. Arryn glanced up as she approached. One tree shadowed the knoll, a laran tree, leaves broad and glossy. Their shadows dappled Arryn's face, made it a patchwork of sun and dark. It was hard to read his expression. She noticed for the first time the way he kept the scarred side of his face out of her line of sight. Or rather, what she noticed for the first time was how common this habit was for him in her presence, and what that meant. She stepped deliberately around him and sat so that he had to face her fully or shift into an awkward, neck-craned position. He faced her, his brow lifted, not so much in amusement as in his awareness of being studied and translated.
"Just a habit," he said,
knowing what she'd seen.
"You have that habit only with me."
He didn't deny it.
"Your scar doesn't matter to me, Arryn."
His expression turned sardonic and interior, as if he were listening to an unheard voice. She groped for the right words, worried that she'd get this wrong. She remembered mocking him in the music room of the Imperial Palace.
"I wonder what you believe could compel me to go to such epic lengths for your sake. Is it your charm, your breeding, not your looks, surely?"
"It matters because it hurts you," she said. "It doesn't change how I see you. You're beautiful. You always have been to me." Even when she hadn't realized it, even in the market nearly a year ago. Then later, when she understood his beauty, Again, when she saw his face torn, stitched, fevered. On the tundra, when his beauty terrified her. Now, too. Her throat closed. The line of his jaw hardened. He didn't believe her. Arin,
I'm sorry for what happened in the village.
She dropped her hand to her lap. She hadn't been conscious of lifting it.
That shouldn't have happened, Arin said.
The crowd's anger toward her had been unsettling, but not surprising. It wasn't only that that troubled him.
What exactly did happen with the mother and her baby?
He tunneled fingers through his hair and rubbed the heel of his hand against his brow.
A misapprehension.
That your god touched?
Kestrel had heard the rumors.
No, that's true. I am.
She stared.
But I don't think the mother would be happy if she knew which god.
He glanced at her, catching her surprise.
My 20th name day was on the winter solstice.
The start of a new Harani year.
But I'm older than that, by the way Valorians reckon time. I was born nearly 2 full seasons before. My mother waited to name me. It was her right. The priests didn't disagree. The name day is meant to celebrate not only the baby, but also the mother's recovery. Women recover differently, so the mother decides when. But in the year I was born, each new mother found a reason to wait until the year turned. You know, don't you, the way we mark time? Each year belongs to one god in the pantheon of the hundred. Each 100 years measures an era. The sign of each god rules once every 100 years. My year, my birth year, belonged to the god of death.
Arin, she said slowly, seeing his anxiety. Do you think you're cursed?
He shook his head.
Your mother named you in the following year. That's your year, then, isn't it? Harani celebrate the name day, not the birthday. It shouldn't matter when you were born.
It matters.
Why?
My whole family. I survived. There's a reason.
Arin.
I didn't know then that I was marked.
Arin, the only reason for what you suffered is that my father is a monster, and he wanted your country.
It's not so simple. I hear the god of death in my head. He advises me, comforts me.
Kestrel wasn't sure what to believe.
I don't know what his blessing means, Arin said. Do you see? When I look at what happened to me, what I've done, what I do, his favor is hard.
Maybe the voice you hear is your own, she said gently, and you just don't recognize it.
He made no reply. She didn't like his belief that death had marked him. His fear and pleasure troubled her. A deep, alien satisfaction lurked in his eyes.
Isn't it possible that you've made this up without meaning to?
I'm his. I know it.
And the baby in the village?
Arin winced.
It would have been a sin to deny the mother. I couldn't. You understand, don't you? I should have told her. But if I had and she withdrew her request, that might catch the god's attention, and what might he do then? If she'd known it was the god of death, she never would have asked.
Kestrel tried to set aside his intricate understanding of cause and effect. It felt beyond her, and dangerous, operating on the whims of an unpredictable deity.
The mother knew whose blessing she sought, she said. It can't be that hard to guess your age, give or take a year. Which god ruled your name year?
Sewing.
She squinted, then laughed. He smiled a little, yet said,
You shouldn't laugh.
She laughed harder.
Actually, I sew quite well.
Perhaps. But you don't exactly seem like the god of sewing's chosen one. The baby's mother knew what she asked for.
The wind stirred the tree. Shadows moved in patterns around them. Kestrel's heart was in her throat even before she knew what she'd say.
Would you do what your mother did? Would you delay the naming of your child for the favor of one god or another?
There was a startled silence.
My child.
Arin tried the words, exploring them. She heard in his voice what she'd seen on his face in the village as he'd held the baby. She looked at the tree. It was a tree, a leaf. Some things just are. They don't signal other meanings. They aren't like a god casting its meaning over an entire year, or like a conversation, which is itself and also all the things that aren't said. Her swift heart scurried along.
It wouldn't be up to me, he said finally. It would be my wife's choice.
She met his eyes. He touched her hot cheek. A tree was not a tree. A leaf, not a leaf. She understood what he didn't say. She stood.
Come, the stream is amazing. Aren't you thirsty? Your horse has better sense than you.
A smile. Teasing. A little shy, too, yet discovering a newfound safety in showing shyness. She held out her hand. He took it. The army camped in the forest on the height of the hills outside Aerolith's manor. Another stream coursed through the trees, wide and rough. It fed over rocks and went down deep. Kestrel went with the women soldiers to bathe. She thought about Sarsine, wishing she had the woman's steady, clear way of seeing things. With a twinge of guilt, Kestrel realized that Sarsine had no way of knowing how or why Kestrel had disappeared from Arryn's house. Kestrel had been incapable of leaving any word behind, and now it was too late. A message, no matter how obliquely worded, could be intercepted and understood. She imagined her father discovering exactly where she was. Her stomach shrank. So instead, she thought about what she'd say to Sarsine when she returned to the city.
I missed you, she'd say. I never thanked you for what you did for me.
She shucked her clothes onto the grass. She needed to feel the water on her skin. It was freezing. She ducked under, opened her eyes, and looked up through the wavering water at the blue and yellow sky. The cold made her remember that her father must have held her once, the way Arryn had held the baby. She held her breath and treaded hard to keep her weight below the surface. It was cold, but the light was beautiful, broken and blurred by the water's rippled silk, as if the sky wasn't simply the sky, but a whole other world. Magic, possible, just within reach. She washed her clothes and didn't wait for them to dry fully before putting them back on. She wrung out her hair and braided it. Wending between the trees, she stepped noiselessly, finding moss or dirt or stone for her feet, never leaves or twigs.
You walk well, her father had said once.
Being quiet is hardly a requisite skill for battle, father.
You could be a ranger, he'd insisted.
But this was after a spectacularly bad training session he'd watched. Her with a sword, the captain of her father's personal guard screaming at her. She knew her father didn't believe his own hope. His voice echoed in her head, and her heart cramped. It felt as if she were underwater again, with someone holding her below the surface. She shoved the memory away. There was only so much she could bear to remember. A game. Make a game of it. How silently can you walk? Let's see. Toe, not heel. Tree root. This patch of earth, darker and therefore soft. Spears of sun pierced through the trees. Her damp braid bounced between her shoulder blades. But there was no one to witness her silence. No one to say, you walk well. Although Kestrel understood the pleasure of doing something for herself alone, had played the piano for hours for her own ears, and to feel the stretch and jump of her fingers, the reach of her long arms, she also knew what it was like to play for someone. It makes a difference. It's hard not to want to be heard, seen, to share. A twig lay in her path. She paused, then deliberately stomped it. Crack!
Fitzy!
The voice echoed in the quiet clearing.
You are doing so nicely.
Rashar. Her eyes found him several paces away, leaning against a tree, watching her. She approached. There was blood on him.
Sometimes, little ghost, you remind me of my sister, he said.
Her brows shot up. He laughed.
Not that one.
Kestrel wasn't sure what connection he saw between her and Risha. Because his younger sister was a hostage in the Imperial Court? Maybe.
Whose blood?
She tipped her chin in the direction of his battered forearms.
A Valorian scout. About your size. I came looking for you. Thought you might like to try her armor. Stylish. Light. Very Valorian. Good condition.
Nary a scratch in the leather.
What about the scout?
Hard to catch, harder to subdue.
She gave him a level look. Rashar tugged a cropped ear.
She's alive.
When that scout doesn't report back, the general will know we're here.
All the more reason to find out what she knows.
Don't press her.
Kestrel, he said quietly. The blood is from the fight when we captured her, not torture.
So you won't?
No, it would be nice if information fell out of the sky. Given that it doesn't, it is still nevertheless comforting that certain people do horrible things so that other people don't have to. We should be grateful to such people. Or we should at least not ask questions when we don't want answers.
She can't help us. Valorian scouts operate in relays. She doesn't report directly to the general's camp, but to a station between there and here. An officer remains at the station and sends hawks with coded messages back to the main camp, which keeps the scout from knowing too much. She won't know how the general's army might have shifted in formation or what the conditions there are. She won't know the codes.
Rashar tilted his head, regarding her.
Do you know the codes?
Kestrel nudged her memory. It pushed back.
I might have, she said slowly. Once.
I'm sure the scout knows something useful.
There's no point torturing her for information she doesn't have. Let her be.
His expression was difficult to read.
I'll do as you wish,
he said finally.
For now.
Thank you.
He slouched against a tree.
Do you forgive me for earlier?
That piece of pageantry in the village. I'm not the one you should be asking.
It's good for Arryn.
Good for you, too.
His black eyes met hers.
You want to win?
Yes.
If Arryn is admired and my people are trusted, does that help or hurt?
Help, she acknowledged.
Come try your armor. I think it'll fit.
Arryn came into Roshar's tent just as the prince tightened the last buckle on Kestrel's armor. Arryn was shaven, his hair wet. Whatever he was going to say died on his lips.
Aren't you pleased?
Rashar said. Arryn immediately left, dropping the flap of the tent's opening behind him. Kestrel found him by his fire at the edge of the camp. It had grown late. He'd pitched his tent on the outskirts. She realized that, at each day's end, he'd been setting his tent farther from everyone else. He fed the fire. She crouched beside him, the leather armor creaking. He flinched at the sound.
I'm sorry, he said finally. It's hard to look at you like that.
I'm still me, she said. Emma surprised at herself for trying to convince him that no matter how she seemed to change, she remained the same person. This wasn't her usual line of argument. As she thought about how she looked in Valorian armor, and whether she looked like herself or not, a germ of an idea began to grow.
Promise me you'll stay out of harm's way, he said. I don't want you on the battlefield.
It's not fair of you to ask that when you'd never do the same.
The risk is different for you and me.
She became angry.
Why? Because you're God-touched. Because you're good with a sword, and I'm not.
That's part of it.
That matters less than you think. People who are good at fighting die in war all the time, and people who aren't can find ways to win.
Her idea, the armor, the Valorian scout, a plan, took shape. Kestrel's anger carved its details and made it perfect.
Yes, Arryn said. But even so, the risk for you is still different.
Stop saying that!
It is.
His face was unhappy.
There is a difference between you and me. If I die, you'll survive. If you die, it will destroy me.
Her shoulders sagged. She couldn't bear his hollow expression. The anger drained from her.
Please, he said. Promise me. You'll still play a role. Tell Roshar and me what to do and we'll listen. But not the battlefield. You're to stay safe.
Slowly, she nodded.
Swear.
I won't be part of the battle. I give you my word.
She moved to leave. She'd not gone two paces before he stood directly in her path. His eyes were narrow.
A trick.
She spread her open hands. You asked, I swore. We're done.
You swore very specifically. I need for you to promise. You'll stay off the battlefield and be safe. Say it, I beg you.
I'll make no promises to you that you won't make to me. She pushed past him.
23.
She entered Rashar's tent.
I need your help.
Blinking, he propped himself up on his bed. He said groggily.
And I need a real door, with a lock.
I have an idea.
I don't know you all that well, and still hearing you say that makes me very, very worried.
Listen to me.
If I do, can I go back to sleep? Being a fearless leader is exhausting.
It's about the Valorian scout.
You said she was useless.
In terms of what she can tell us, but if we play things right, her capture will be to our advantage.
Rashar was fully awake now.
Go on.
The general is in his position with his troops at the estate they captured. A scout station is set between his position and a target. An officer remains at that station with message hawks. Meanwhile, scouts run from the station to evaluate the enemy, then report back to the station. The officer sends a coded message by hawk to the general, so if a scout's captured, she can't share much with the enemy, and since scouts get close to the target, they can't launch a hawk. Too visible to us. We might shoot it down, then track and capture the scout. That Valorian you caught spying on us can't tell us any codes, and won't be able to say much about the general's forces. But she will know the location of the relay station, and to whom she reports.
You want us to hunt down and extract information from the officer?
She shook her head.
Something better.
Pray tell, little ghost.
Send me in her place.
He stared. Kestrel said,
I'll pretend to be her.
Please understand. When I look at you as if you're crazy, it's not that I judge you for your insanity.
I fit in her armor. I'm her size. I'm Valorian.
You don't look like her. Just because you're Valorian doesn't mean the officer at the relay station won't notice that you're a completely different person.
It's night. I can report to the officer while keeping my distance.
I'm going back to sleep. Wake me when you're sane.
Impatiently, Kestrel said.
What color is her hair?
Different.
How different?
Brownish. All right, maybe not that different from yours in the dark, but...
I'll braid my hair like hers, wear everything she wore. Did you search her pockets? She'll have had a token. Sometimes the general sends an officer to relieve the one at the station. Then the new officer and a scout, and there are many of these scouts, not just this one reporting to a station, present a token to confirm their identity. We might get lucky. There might be a new officer at the station, one who's never seen the scout but knows her only by name. Rashar, no one would expect someone in your army to impersonate a Valorian scout. Normally it wouldn't be possible. Not for an Easterner, not for a Herani.
What if the Valorians know you're with us? That stationed officer might be aware of it.
If my father knows, he'll do his best to keep it hidden from as many people as possible.
Why?
There was a lump in her throat.
He's ashamed of me. It would shame him for others to know.
Rashar settled back into the bed, arms folded.
What would we gain if you pretended to be the Valorian scout?
Misinformation. Let's assume the general knows of our presence here. If he doesn't, he will soon enough. The issue isn't whether he'll attack, it's how. I can influence that. I'll say you have a light force which other Valorian scouts, if they're eyeing us, will confirm. But I'll also say that I overheard plans that you'll entrench yourselves in Aerilith's manner.
Rashar was already off the bed, leafing through the maps spread out on the table in the tent's center.
He'd take the main road, then, Kestrel said. He wouldn't expect resistance along the way, or at most he'd expect stealth attacks by small bands of soldiers. There to strike and run, to whittle away at him, like by burning the supply wagons. Nothing serious, nothing he couldn't handle, nothing that would stop him from taking the easiest and most obvious way to Aerilith.
There are hills along the main road outside the estate. I can set our forces on either side.
Use the guns. They have a longer range than crossbows. If you position the gunners far enough away, they can shoot without ever being touched by Valorian fire.